We've been working through 1 Peter. We're going to be in 1 Peter the rest of the fall, and then we'll stop and do Advent for a season, and then after the Advent season, we'll come back to 2 Peter, and then we'll be done with our year of Peter, because we've been with Peter since May, did his life, and now his writings. And so here's where I want to start this morning. I grew up in a culture where the answer to this question, to drink or not to drink, was never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, are Christians to drink alcohol in any circumstances ever. Is that clear? And so as I grew up, I remember not necessarily agreeing with this idea and starting to question this thing. And so I remember asking my elders, like Sunday school teachers and such, like, okay, so what if you're a missionary and you're in a culture like Germany where beer flows from the taps in the public restrooms, is what I've been told, and there is no water in sight. Can you drink beer then? And the answer is never, ever, ever are Christians to drink alcohol ever, ever, ever. And I know, because I know our church, that that's not how most of us answer that question these days. But what about all the other ethics of the Bible? How do we know when to take an ethic from the Bible and say, oh, the Bible says this in this morning's passage, women, submit to your husbands. That's where we're going this morning, just so you know where this is headed. How do we know when to take something and go, it's really clear what the Bible says at that point. It says, women, submit to your husbands. It also says right before it, slaves, submit to your masters, even if they're cruel, and especially if they're cruel, submit to your masters too. And in American churches, go back about 200 years ago, that was preached with regularity. Whenever we talked about women submitting, we also talked about slaves submitting, but we've decided not to talk about that anymore. We just talk about the women part still. So how do we know to stop talking about slaves and to keep talking about women? Or do we stop talking about women too? Is that sufficient? Get the problem? And so this morning, we're going to wade into some of this stuff. And this passage in particular is full of ethical commands from Peter. I'll put them up there in a minute, but I counted, I think there's about 18 different commands from Peter. Do this thing, and do this, and do this, and do this. And how do we know? How do we know when to do the thing, and when do we say, maybe not so much? So that's what we're going to get into this morning. If you know anything from being around here, though, part of the answer to that question is understanding context and knowing the context that it was written in and the context about who it was written to. This letter was written about 2,000 years ago to a specific region of the world where they had specific issues, specific problems, specific things that they were thinking about. And so sometimes what Peter says, for example, or what Paul says may be progressive to their culture, but we look at it as regressive. Sometimes he's saying things that have a very specific intent and very specific application in their culture, and we go, I don't know what that has to do with anything with us today. And so I want to give you just a little bit of that context before we read the passage this morning. And so I want to go through like just five things in terms of what it meant to be a Jewish Christian living in Anatolia. Anatolia is the Roman designation for what we know today as Turkey, or also known in some places as Asia Minor. Right? Everybody know where that is on a map? You just nod and pretend you do. All right? You'll save us time. So here's what it meant to be a Christian in Anatolia. If you were a Christian, even before Peter wrote this letter, wait, by the way, I'm going to interrupt myself. We've got these cool new sheets for kids. Does any kids grab them on the way in? Yeah, can I hold one of these up? These are awesome. Jesse printed these up where you can count how many times I say things like Peter. Last service, it was reported to me I said the word Peter 59 times. I didn't say the Holy Spirit any times. I only said Jesus 12. So if you're keeping stats, kids can keep stats on the message. I just think it's fun, and it keeps some of them engaged, all right? So if you're playing along, I think I've done 5 Peters. So, I don't know. Here's what it means to be a Jewish Christian living in Anatolia, is that before even Peter's letter arrives, you know that part of what it means to be a Christian is that you can't worship the Roman emperor or Roman gods. That even though your friends and neighbors and your boss and maybe your master or your husband worships Roman gods, you aren't allowed to do that because of your faith. Does that seem reasonable enough? All Christians everywhere agree with this, all right? They're all in agreement, all right? Specifically, what that means then is if you're a Christian woman, you can't be a keeper of the flame. And I know that's really important to you all to be keepers of the flame. Here's what this means. In Roman mythology, in Roman worship, the Vestal Virgins kept the flames of Rome. There was literally in Rome a flame that was kept burning at all times forever and ever by the Vestal Virgins, a group of six women, I think it was six women, whose responsibility was to keep the flame going. The flame represented the heart of Rome. It was to let everybody know that Rome is still alive. The fire is still burning. Kind of like the Olympic Games where the fire is burning and when the fire goes out, games are over. Same idea that the eternal flame was always going to let everybody know that the empire is alive and well. The Vestal Virgins made sure that flame kept lit. And so part of what it meant to be a Roman woman throughout the empire is in a metaphorical way, you kept the flame going in your family by teaching your children the pantheon of Roman gods and goddesses, that you raise your children up to worship that way. And if you're a Christian woman, you know that to be faithful to Jesus means you can't teach your children Roman values and how to worship the Roman gods, and so you can't be a keeper of the flame. And everybody understands that, right? Well, of course, if you can't worship the gods, you don't want to teach your children to worship the gods. Thirdly, if you're a slave, you can't participate in the religion of your masters. So I want you to think in the Bible story about the Philippian jailer. When the Philippian jailer becomes a Christian and gets baptized, it says in the text, he and whom got baptized? His whole, not his family, even bigger than his family, his whole household. Which in a Roman setting, don't think of just your kids. Think about slaves, kids, everybody that lives under your roof, cousins, whoever lives under your roof. So the whole culture is built on paterfamilias, male heads of households. And whoever lives in your household, when you convert to a religion, they all convert as well. And we see that in the Philippian jailer. So part of what it means to be a Jewish Christian in Anatolia is that you can't participate in the religion of your master. If your master converts to another religion, you can't convert because you're faithful to Jesus. Just real quick, time out before I do the last two. Do you see the tensions that are arising? Do you see the tensions that they feel? So when Peter writes this, he's writing into an environment that is full of tensions about what does it mean to be a Christian and live in my world. The last two things, real quick, is that if you're a Roman or if you're a Christian, you can't participate in honor challenges and other pagan vices. All this to say, I can get into a long thing on this, but let me just say this. You're being left out of some of the things in your culture. There's things that are happening that you have to choose as a Christian that I will not participate in this. And you would get into discussions about meat sacrifice to idols and Roman honor matches and killing and all those things that Christians were saying, oh, as Christians, we understand we can't participate in those things. And then finally, I said this when we did the introduction, that there's rumors of violence coming from Rome. If you're a Jewish Christian living in Anatolia, you perhaps now have begun to hear rumors of what Nero is doing in Rome. And at least we think Peter knows of those things as he's writing this letter, that it's what causes Peter to write, that there is actual physical, we're killing Christians now, that's what Nero's doing, and that starts to have reverberations throughout the empire. Okay? That's the setting. Turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 2, and we'll read together. Here's what it says. Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visited us. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as God's slaves. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor. Slaves, in reverent fear of God, submit yourself to your masters, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. For it is commendable if somebody bears up or someone bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because they are conscious of God. But how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, that is commendable before God. To this you were called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate when he suffered. He made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but now you have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Wives, in the same way, submit yourselves to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles and the wearing of gold jewelry. Sorry, I have a hard time with that word. Or fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of your inner self, an unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to adorn themselves. They submitted themselves to their husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her Lord. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Finally, all of you, be like-minded, be sympathetic, love one another, be compassionate and humble, do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult. On the contrary, repay evil with blessing because to this you are called so that you may inherit a blessing. For whoever would love life and see good days must keep their tongue from evil and their lips from deceitful speech. They must turn from evil and do good. They must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against all who do evil. Now, that's a lot of text, and I want to hear what you have to think and process together, but we're going to break it down in smaller sections. Before I do, I counted 18 imperatives. 18 things that Peter says, I urge you to do these things. And that's a list of all those things. And sometimes one way to approach this, if the pastor I grew up under, he was great. I loved him. And here's how he'd start every sermon. He'd read the text and he'd say what he'd say right now. What would he say, Jeff? He'd say this. He always pulled his pant legs up. 18 observations on this text, number one. And he'd go through every one of them and we'd go through every one of these things, what it means, all right? Sorry, no 18-point sermon from me this morning. We're not doing that. But the question is what should we do with all these things? And I think if we break them into smaller sections, we can have that discussion. So here we go. 1 Peter 2, 11 through 12. And let me just go back to there and it says this. Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from evil desires. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they may accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. What do you see? What are your comments, questions? What does this text seem to be saying? Anything of significance? Anything ringing in your head? Well, fine. I'll tell you what I see. Peter starts this, by the way, with dear friends. The word there is agapatas. It's from agape. It's a highly unusual way to start this conversation. In Roman literature, we very rarely find writers addressing each other. Some of your translations say beloved here. We rarely find people saying, hey, the people I love. We do it in the English, hey, friends. And the reason for that is in this passage in particular, now I want to set up the context. Remember that we've said 1 Peter 1, 13 through 16, that therefore with minds are alert and fully sober, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you in Jesus Christ that's coming, that some of the kids are memorizing and getting candy bars out of Dustin for. That section, we've said that's his key argument, that be holy in everything you do because he who called you is holy. That's the whole point of the book. And what we're in right now is this is the second argument Peter's making, trying to explain that whole idea. And last week, Dustin talked about his section where it was unpacking that. In this one, Peter's going to start putting real practical, here's what it means to be holy in everything you do. And what he's going to say to women, to slaves, and to men, which covers pretty much everybody in the audience, everything he said is going to come as a shock to their system. Everything that Peter's going to say, the way they're going to hear it is, whoa, Peter's saying some pretty intense stuff right here. And so he starts with this, friends. And part of it is that we know that Peter's ministry through much of his life was in Anatolia. And so really, it's not disingenuous. It's not the TV preacher looking into the camera and saying, friends, send me your money. It's not that. Peter probably likely knows the people he's writing to. He knows their names. He knows their faces. He knows the churches. He may have started many of these churches. And so he starts with this very beloved, like, oh, friends, let's talk, because I've got some hard things to say, but we're friends. And so I'm going to say them in as loving way as I can. And then the summary for this passage is there in verse 12. Live such good lives among the pagans that although they may accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Which leads us into verse 13. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority. And he talks about the emperor there. For 15, for it is God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people. Do not use your freedom as a cover up from evil. Live as God's slave. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor. Questions, comments, things that don't settle well. Just remarks in general. Remarks on the weather. Ariana. Okay, so there's this idea that perhaps this is saying that we should honor our president, even if we don't agree. What else? Yeah. So I'm going to, since you stole a slide later, I'll use the idea of tightrope. Peter's walking this tightrope, and we're going to see this in all these sections, where he's saying there's a way to live where there's tensions for sure. And you can be a jerk about how you go about living in those tensions, or you can find a way to make it as good as possible. The illustration that came to my mind this week over and over again is the Old Testament story of Daniel. Remember Daniel, where he's brought in, and they want him to eat the king's meat, and Daniel says, whoa, I don't eat that stuff. I'll eat vegetables only. And he does it in this really gracious, like, let's just do a test. Feed me vegetables. We'll see how it goes. And he earns the favor of people because he goes about living in such a way, I can't do this, but I'll try to make up for it in all these other ways that I do. It's like your boss saying, I need you to work till 6 every night. And you say, I can only work till 5, but what if I come in at 5 a.m.? What if I work through my lunch? What if I do this, this, and this? To make up for the fact that I can't do this over here, let me do these things and do these things so well that you're going to go, oh man, it's fine. Does that make sense? That's what he seems to be saying. Anything else from this passage? Any tensions? Yeah, you get this sense sometimes that Paul wants to fight, like with words, but he wants to fight. He wants to argue. He wants to come up with a reasoned argument. And Peter seems to be much more about how do we live at peace? And part of that, again, is context. Remember I said that one of the primary motivations of this passage, and we're going to get to it next week, where Peter really gets to where I think he really wants to go, where he's talking about the suffering of the church. And he wants to say some things about suffering, and he knows that's happening, and he knows it's only going to get worse. And he's trying to help them understand, with suffering happening and coming, here's a way to live at peace among people. And he's really concerned with that. And I would argue that as we get to this passage, we'll see it even more clearly, because his mission is twofold, to be missional and evangelistic. Peter sees it as an opportunity, especially right here where it says, for it is by God's will that you should silence their ignorant talk. That he sees it as an evangelistic thing, that if you live this way, people will come to faith because of that. He's super optimistic about that. He's also super optimistic. A couple things I'll point out. He's also super optimistic about the emperor, right? So if you track the New Testament writings about the emperor, I was always taught Romans 13, like honor that whatever it says there about respecting the emperor, you know, follow the empire. And it was always this, hey, we need to support whatever America does. But if you track the progression across the New Testament, that's Paul early on. Peter is a little bit more nuanced here, isn't he? Respect the emperor, show the proper respect for the emperor, because Peter has some now misgivings about authority. And just a secret, but by the time you get to John and the Revelation, the emperor is evil, and the empire is evil, and we're supposed to resist the empire. And so you see this progression in the early church of their thinking and going, well, the government's changing and our response to it's changing as well, but we see this in Peter like saying respect. And I just want to point out, if you look the first line, 13, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human. Maybe even a better word than authority here is probably creature. It's more comprehensive than just the authorities. It's respect everybody. If you contrast that across the column back to the page to verse 22, he talks about now that you've purified yourself by obeying the truth, or go down to 114 as obedient children. Peter is super clear. We obey God. We respect other people. And don't confuse the two. Because remember the tensions Peter's facing. He is not going to say to Christian wives, obey your husband in the worship of Roman gods. He is not going to say to slaves, hey, obey your masters in who you should worship. He's going to tell both women and slaves, disobey and respect at the same time. Do you understand that? We don't hear that when we read it today at all. We don't. That's just not what it says. Submit. It's really simple. But that's what they're hearing. Is they're hearing he's calling them to disobey, but at the same time to respect. I'm all over my notes right now, so let me catch up. So this page down here. Verse 15, for it is God, by God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. The Greek wording here for doing good has a specific application in the Roman world. And what he's talking about is civic benefactions, doing good stuff for your city, which two things happen here. One is we see that Peter is writing to some people in his audience who appear to be wealthy. We often think of the early church as poor and at the margins of society. At least some people in Peter's audience likely have wealth. And we see that in this language about women and braided hair. Apparently, if you braid your hair, you're rich, all right? And some of you are like self-conscious now about the jewelry you have on. But he's talking to people that at least some of them have wealth. And so because of their wealth, they can do good things for their city. And in the Roman Empire, there were specific things that you could do if you were wealthy, a benefactor. There were certain things that you could do. You could do civic projects, restore buildings. You could, in times of famine, negotiate trades to bring more grain to your city, to help supply the poor with grain. There's lots of ways you could do to help the city. And when you did that, at the city square, there would often be monuments. And they find this in excavations today. They find monuments of, they're called the Yergetai, these people that were wealthy benefactors of the city. So what Peter's encouraging his churches to do, now listen to this, this is really big, and this is not the way the American church often thinks. What he's encouraging his churches to do is in your cities, do good for the city. Do things that benefit the city so read it. For it is God's will that by doing good in your city, civic good for the city, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. He's saying that by doing good for your city, you build a good reputation for Christians. What Seth was saying, it's a peaceful way to live. And Peter always has this idea, and Peter's super, probably more optimistic than most of us, that when you do good for the city, when you do things that benefit the city and are good for everyone, then Jesus looks good and people want to come into the faith because it's good for everybody. Doesn't that run counter to a lot of the language and the rhetoric that you hear in Christian circles today? I mean, if you listen to Christian radio and Christian authors, a lot of times they're talking about retreat. Don't do things that are good for the church, build more for the church, spend money on the church, send money over there. You don't hear a lot of talk about how do we as a church do things that are good for Peoria? That's what Peter's calling his people to do. Also in this section, he encourages them to live as free people. Somebody asked in the first service, how do they live as free people when they're slaves and women? And according to Roman law, they're not exactly free. And Peter's talking about this willingness. Mary Gerke said it really well in the first service, that when you're a slave, you're in bondage. And you can do it out of duty, or you can do it as a free person in your head, that I willingly submit to this. I willingly do this because I do it as Jesus did. And he's talking about this inner freedom, and it's a hint at something he's going to say later. I'll leave for just a minute. And then show proper respect. We kind of talk about that, which brings us to this section, household codes. So throughout the Roman Empire, you can find writings about household codes. And a couple things I want to point out to you. First of all, slaves are never mentioned. The slaves aren't worth mentioning. And so they just aren't part of the household codes. What was believed in Rome, I think it was Aristotle has some pretty intense stuff about this in the early Greek codes. And he talks about, like, if the empire is going to be healthy, you need a healthy emperor, but you also need homes that are healthy, which gets to the honor codes and the religion of hearth and home or whatever, keepers of the flame, that kind of stuff. And so they understand that the relationship that society keeps boiling down to, the relationship between husband, wife, family, all that stuff, and then it just keeps working up from there. And so there's a lot of writing about how you live as a woman in a Greek home, how you live as a man in a Greek home, how you live as a child in a Greek home. And so there's a lot, or a Roman context. And so there's a lot to that in the household codes. And so Peter is not making up some new categories. Paul does the same thing. He's mirroring some things that are in the culture and putting his own twist on them. Hey, you kind of what Jesus does in the Sermon on the Mount. You know, the you have heard it said, but I say unto you, that's what they're doing here, even if they don't use that exact same language. And then in all these cases, in the slaves, at least slaves and women, Peter is concerned with the subordinate party. So let's just be really clear why. If you're a man, if you're the paterfamilias, and you switch religions, is there any problem in your family? The answer is no. Everybody, come on, together. Wake up. All right? The answer is no. It's really warm in here, and everybody's getting comfortable. No, there's no problem. If you're a slave and you meet Jesus somehow, is there a problem? Not yes. Yes, there's a problem. If you're a woman and you convert to Christianity, is there a problem? Yes. In all these cases, it causes significant tension in the home because you're not following the expected norms. You're disobeying your husband, you're disobeying your master. And so Peter's addressing those two groups. He's briefly going to talk to husbands, but mostly he's going to talk to those two groups because that's where the tensions lie in this church. And then Peter isn't saying anything about what should be. He's just talking about what the culture is. And so we're going to unpack that a little bit. So let's talk about slaves. Slaves, verse 18, in reverent fear of God, submit yourselves to your masters, not only those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. And then he goes on and says that, hey, if you get beat because you're a bad slave, there's no commendation in that. But if you're doing good, if your master is beating you because you're doing good stuff, well, then you're like Jesus. Thoughts, comments, questions? Somebody told me after the first service they heard this passage preached in their church when they were younger, and it was used to say that you couldn't be in unions. The pastor was preaching that. Yeah, some of you are laughing. I'm not going to say that this morning. But this passage was used to say you can't be in a union because to file a grievance is to violate what Peter's saying here. No matter how harsh your master is, you just have to take it, which is very different from our culture, I'm just saying. Any thoughts? Oh, yeah, so there is this sense in which, that in a healthy way, that they're supposed to remind themselves that when I'm in this situation, I'm like Jesus. Yeah, yeah. What else? Yep. This particular section is addressed to oiketai. That's the word up on the screen, oiketai. Specifically, the Greek root there is oikos, which is home. These are household servants. You should think of these servants as Downton Abbey. That kind of thing, but not getting a paycheck, all right? But the familiarity with the family, the closeness with the family is what would have been this group. Now, there are words that apply to more of what we think of in American slavery. That does exist in Roman culture at all. He's not addressing that at all. He's not talking about industrial slaves, you know, victims of war, those kinds of things. He's talking about, and in the paterfamilias, there were slaves, household servants, who chose it, who willingly entered into that because they could be attached to a household. They're taken care of under the paterfamilias. And so it's a fuzzy system. It's not what we think. It's still bad, but it's not quite what we think. So there's some familiarity there. Anything else? Yes. Yeah. So keeping their vindication, the rights will be wronged. Let me ask you a question. What is Peter asking of slaves to do? Is he asking them to obey their masters? Is he asking them to obey? He's asking them to submit to them, but is he asking them to obey to the point at which worship other gods and those kinds of things? Peter's giving slaves freedom to disobey in that regard. And so what he's doing is trying to provide this place where, okay, so you're a slave. Here's how you can be like Jesus, even though it's going to cause tension with your master about this. Here's how you be such a good slave in his presence, which is really, really difficult, right? It's challenging. And then the beauty of this passage, the beauty of this section, then we'll get to the women thing, is he tells slaves, and writing to the church, oh, I should have said this part. I missed one thing. The fact that he includes slaves at all in the discussion is huge. So the first audience, when they hear this and they hear Peter in his letter to us is addressing slaves, that's a big deal that he's honoring them by even addressing them, first of all. But then who is the example for slaves? So what the rest of the church is supposed to do is when we look at the slaves that are suffering, who are we supposed to equate them with? Jesus. That they become the example in the early church, the closest example of what it means to follow Jesus. So they get this place of honor. And what Peter's doing is giving them a place of honor in the early church and saying, it's a horrible spot they're in and what they have to endure. But in that, they're the ones that are like Jesus. We learn a lot from them on how to be like Jesus. Then Peter says, in the same way, wives, submit yourself to your own husbands so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives And then he goes on and talks about how they dress. And then he talks about the example of Sarah. Let me just ask some questions to move us along quickly, all right? What men are they supposed to submit to, first of all? Just who? And not just husbands. Which husbands? Your own husband. So let's just be really clear. This is not saying all women everywhere are supposed to submit to every man everywhere. Is it saying that? Absolutely not. It's saying specifically in this circumstance, wives, submit to your own husbands. Okay? Who is the husband in this? Tell me about the husband. What do we know about him in this circumstance? He's an unbeliever. Peter is writing to a very specific circumstance in this situation, right? You have a woman who's apparently a believer because he's writing to her, and her husband does not believe. And he's saying to this woman in this circumstance, submit to your husband. Why? Because you're inferior to him? Is that what he's saying? Why is he telling her to submit? There's a very specific reason he's asking her in freedom to submit to him. Why is he asking her to do so? To win him over. It's an evangelistic effort to submit to him to win him over. And I'm just going to jump ahead real fast. What does he say to a Christian husband? Now he's talking to a Christian husband. If you go down to verse 7, how is a Christian husband and wife supposed to relate to each other? He gives husbands a very specific command here about how they're supposed to relate to each other. If you're a Christian husband and Christian wife, how are you supposed to relate? As heirs together. That what Peter's doing is saying, hey, whoa, now listen. Now, if we set the circumstance, let's say there's a husband that's a Christian and a wife that's a Christian, he's supposed to be considerate and he's supposed to treat her with respect as the weaker partner. That's just how women described themselves back then. Don't get hung up on that. The women writers of that era referred to themselves as weaker partners. He's not being as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life. That if you're a Christian husband, this is how you're supposed to relate to your wife as we are in this together. Do you understand the progression here? That what Peter's doing is so specific to a context. Peter's not concerned about forever and ever, let's keep women in their place. Peter's ultimate concern, I think, is that we live in freedom and that we live as co-heirs, as brothers and sisters in Christ. That's how husbands and wives and men and women are supposed to relate to each other. But in the Roman paterfamilias, if you're in that system and your husband believes in that and you're in there, then submit to him in that and be a great wife so that he will be won over by your goodness. Just like Christians living in their culture are doing good benefactions to win over the culture. Just like slaves who are stuck in an awful circumstance live as good slaves to win over their masters. Wives, submit your husbands. And when you're both believers, then treat each other with mutual respect. Which then he goes in to flesh out. Finally, all of you, be like-minded, be sympathetic, love one another, be compassionate and humble, do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult. On the contrary, repay evil with blessing. That he understands that when believers relate to each other, we relate to each other in these ways of mutuality and love. I've just botched all my slides, but here's what Peter thinks. I think this is how Peter unpacks things, and my slides are catching up. That in the passage, we obey God. Obedience is something that we give to God and God alone. We love other believers. There's mutuality, there's respect, there's honor. We're like-minded with each other. And then to everybody else, we honor and respect everybody else. That we find ways to live at peace. Peter's concern, somebody in the first service said this really well. Peter's concern is one, how do you be a Christian and not get yourself killed? How do you be a Christian in this culture and not get yourself killed by your master or your spouse or how do you get the culture not to stone you? How do you live in a way that's at peace in your culture and does the most good in your culture? How do you do that? And then Peter, being wildly optimistic, believes that when we do that, then people will think better of Jesus because of the way we live. And he finishes, by the way, there with a quote from Psalm 34 to emphasize this point. So if Peter were asked the question to drink or not to drink, that is the question. How does Peter answer? Well, I think for Peter, it would depend on mission. And it would depend on, can somebody be won over in this activity? How do we think through this in a missional, evangelistic way? Because the words that Peter uses, by the way, can we go back to the very first verse that I read? What does Peter say to us in this? Does he say, "These are the things I command to you of all time. Wives, submit to your husbands." That's not what he says. What's the word he uses? I urge you. The word urge is somewhere beneath I command and more than I ask, all right? Somewhere in that space. He's not just saying, I'm asking. He's saying, this is important. I think you should live this way. But at the same time, Peter is not saying, I command this to you for now and for all time. Women shall forever be submissive to their husbands and men everywhere. That's also an expansion of this that just seems so silly. That Peter's driven by mission and he's walking, Seth said this earlier, Peter's walking this tightrope between how do we live in a culture and how do we navigate our way through this. So this winter, late spring, April 18th to be precise, or April 17th, we had lots of rain. I don't know if you remember this, but we had lots and lots of rain. And near where I live is a creek, Kickapoo Creek. I think every direction you go from my house, you have to cross Kickapoo Creek. I don't know how that happens. I've never actually seen a map of how the place where I live. That creek in the place where I live, it goes everywhere. And anyway, so there was a morning where the kids left for school and I was leaving for work. And I got down to Kickapoo Creek, which is usually about 10 or 12 feet below the bridge. And there's fields down in the bottoms here. And so this is a farmer's field out where I live. That's 4 feet of water over the whole top of his field. I'm not kidding. About 3 to 4 feet over the top of his field. This is the creek up here where you shouldn't drive and video at the same time. I'm just saying, public service announcement. But this is the creek itself. Usually that's 10 feet down from the bridge there. It's all the way up over the banks, 4 feet over his field. There's a little berm and then his field. So it just flowed into his field. It was so bad, the poor guy, he had to bring in bulldozers and excavators to get the field back to level because so much silt had come up out of the creek and dumped in his field and washed away a bunch of topsoil that he had to go into his field with a bulldozer and push soil around to get the field back to flat, and then he planted the field. And then it happened again. A couple weeks later, this happened again. The creek came back up out of it and washed out his whole field again. And so he had to bring in the bulldozer and the excavators all to do it again. Except this time, in the middle of the field, and if you drive out on that road today, right out in the very middle of the field, there's this huge stump in the middle of his field. It's probably 8 or 10 feet tall. It's the whole bottom part of a tree, and it's right in the middle of his field. And I don't know the farmer. I don't know exactly what he's thinking. But my guess is that it was already past time. He had already planted his field twice. He was working on his third planting of the year, hoping this one wouldn't get washed away. And he brought in the bulldozers and the excavators. But to get that stump out of there was going to be a much bigger job and take a lot longer time. And so today, if you look at the harvest, he basically planted his whole field and just went around the stump. And he planted his field to get the most out of his field that he could, with the stump still there. I think this passage is exactly like that. I think if Peter were sitting here today and we asked him, Peter, what do you think about paterfamilias? I think he would say, in a Christian home? No way. In a Christian home, husbands and wives are to treat each other with respect. In a Christian home, Paul even says this to Philemon, Philemon, let Onesimus go. I think that Peter, if he were sitting here today, would say, well, I think the trajectory was supposed to be to get away from these distinctions between male and female and Jew and Gentile and slave and free. We were supposed to be moving away from that. And I think Peter today, if he were sitting here and I asked him about paterfamilias, he'd say, it's a stump. And I just had to work around the stump. I had to find all the ways that I could find to be a Christian and to be a good Christian in the culture and in the society. And I just had to, there's the stump there and it just had to sit there. And I know it was bad. I didn't love it, but it was just there and it's what I had to work with. And so we worked around it until the harvest is done. And then, then we'll address the stump. And I would guess that the farmer this year will do the stump. Or a good friend of mine said after service, she said, you know what? Sometimes, well, if the stump sits there long enough, the stump will take care of itself. And sometimes these things take a long time to work out in the culture. Sometimes paterfamilias takes 2,000 years to get rid of, right? And so as a church and as individuals, I think the question when we come to 1 Peter, at least in this section, when we start talking about ethics, is how is the best way to live as a Christian? And yes, there's things in our culture that we don't love. Yes, there are rules. There are things in our culture that we shouldn't participate in, that as Christians, we should stand up to and we should stand up for. But we don't use that as an opportunity to say, hey, there's things I don't like, so I'm going to take my ball and go home. I'm not planting my field this year. That's just not an option. And so often when you listen, I think, when I listen to Christians and read Christian books and blogs and some other places, what I hear is just retreat from the culture. Let's just get away and it's all going to hell anyway. Just let it go. And I don't think that's what Peter's calling us to do. I think Peter's calling us to get out in the field and plant the field everywhere that you can. And if there's a stump, just go around it for now. We'll deal with it later when we can. But for now, figure out what it means to follow Jesus in the best ways that you can. So that in the best scenario, maybe people in Brimfield look at Jennifer and I and say, hey, their marriage, boy, there's something about that marriage and how they relate to each other that's like Jesus. Or maybe there's something about that family and how they do good that's different than everything else. And I know they're a little strange and they go to church every Sunday morning and they don't do this or this thing, but man, there's just something about them that's good. And maybe people look at our church and they say, you know what? Church people in general are strange. Right? Somebody asked me to name the most normal person at Imago Dei Church the other day and I was stumped. I couldn't think of anybody normal. Everybody I'd think, I'd be like, nope, they're not normal either. But maybe people would think, boy, that's a strange group of people that meet up in that building, but man, they do such good for our city and this neighborhood that, wow, we just love them even though they're odd. I think that's a church people would get excited about, and I think that's communities that people would get excited about, and I think that's small groups that Peter would get excited about that are engaging in conversations about how do we live in such a way that it's compelling to people to want to follow Jesus. And that's what drives our ethic, is this move for us to do good so that other people will want to follow. Let's pray. I thank you for the early church and how they wrestled with things and worked through stuff. And I just love that we get to see how they worked through stuff. And help us to be that kind of a church. Help us to be that kind of a people that's having these kind of conversations about how do we live as followers of you? How do I live in a marriage relationship or in a work relationship? Or how do I live just as a neighbor in such a way that it compels people to want to follow you? And yeah, there's stumps out there, but we just work around them and we try to be as good as we can in as many ways as we can. So help us in that. Help us to have great conversations that push us into that. In your name I pray. Amen.